Join us in Omaha, Nebraska on Saturday, October 8th, 2022, as I'm proud to present Historic Haunted Heartland, a night of incredible true stories of paranormal phenomena, with not one, not two, but three paranormal experts alive on stage at the newly renovated and beautiful Benson Theater in the heart of Omaha. The fun starts with Omaha historian and paranormal investigator Jamie Nestrel as she reveals the true details on the dark history of Omaha. Next, Johnny Hauser, the longtime caretaker and nation's leading expert on the Villisca Axe Murder House. We're going to explore the crimes committed there with him and the history of its haunting. And finally, making his debut in Omaha, John E. L. Tenney will deliver one of his signature weird lectures. Tickets are available this summer, and I invite you to visit Necronomicast.com and follow the show on Facebook for more information. Historic Haunted Heartland, brought to you by Necronomicast, Saturday, October 8th, 2022, a night that could change your life or afterlife. From the historic Haunted Heartland in Omaha, Nebraska, my name is Brian Corey, and it is my pleasure to welcome you all to this episode of Necronomicast, the finest in creepy conversations. Hey, I'm celebrating the summer of Sasquatch over here on the show, with all of July being dedicated to the big guy. I'm going to kick it off with author and researcher Ken Gerhard, whose book, The Essential Guide to Bigfoot, should be on the shelf of every researcher and enthusiast out there. Ken's shared his research findings and knowledge on Coast to Coast AM, the History Channel, Sci-Fi, National Geographic, A&E, Weird or What with William Shatner. And now, with you faithful listeners on this episode of Necronomicast. And now calling in on the Necronomicast hotline, I'm so excited to have from the San Antonio area, cryptozoologist, researcher, author, explorer, adventurer, Ken Gerhard. Ken, I am so excited to have you on the program. How are you doing?
Good evening, Brian. It's awesome to be here with you. It's definitely an honor and a pleasure to come on your show.
Whenever I'm looking for, well, thank you. But whenever I'm looking for guests, I always look for people that I find interesting. And your sense of adventure and just everything about you, I'm like, man, I got to get this guy on the program and start talking some Sasquatch. I haven't had a Sasquatch show in a while, so.
Well, I'm always down for talking Sasquatch.
I bet.
Now you anytime, brother.
You wrote this book, man, and I was so excited to order it, and it was so nice of you to personalize it too. The Essential Guide to Bigfoot. And I really, really enjoyed it because, you know, when you pick up a Bigfoot book, I'm always thinking like, well, probably a third of it I've read about it before, or, you know, people kind of rehash things and over, but this is not an exaggeration. This is an essential guide to Bigfoot, man. You've condensed all this great folklore and history and research and your adventures, everything into a really enjoyable book. So my compliments to
you. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I've been researching Bigfoot since I was a little kid, so over 40 years. But it never occurred to me to write a book, even though I'd written books on other topics in cryptozoology. But, you know, a couple of years ago, it occurred to me that, you know, particularly from social media, I just noticed there's so much misinformation flying around out there and being propagated. And, you know, I think if people are genuinely interested in the Bigfoot mystery, they at least should have the best information. And I'm not saying that it's just my information. This is, as you said, it's accumulated. It's sort of a consensus opinion of all of the leading Bigfoot investigators through the years that I've followed and read and worked with. And even though there's a lot of things we don't agree on, because I mean, Bigfoot is a big unknown, right?
Right.
But there are some general ideas and concepts that we tend to all agree on. And, you know, I think that, you know, that's probably the best information, the most accurate information that people can have will help them to sort of form their own objective opinion about whether they think it exists or doesn't exist and what it is and so on and so forth.
Now, I think we're similar age. I'm going to show you a copy of a book that I'm putting your book next to in my Necronomicast library. But this is a book that I fell in love with. It's called Bigfoot All Over the Country.
I got that one.
Yeah. By Marion Place.
Marion T. Place. Yep.
And this was like the hot book. I was born in 1974, and I think this book was written in 78. But when I was in elementary school, this was like the hot book of the library. Like, a real quick story. All these kids were always checking it out, and I always went back to go check it out. And it's like, oh, it's not in. Bobby's got it. Johnny's got it. Lisa's got it. And so I was just really bummed. And then it was like the next to last day of school. Maybe it was the last day of school. And I went into the library with Mrs. Gates, and I'm like, is the Bigfoot book in yet? And she's like, no, no. But then the kid that had it turned it in later that day because it was the end of school. And Mrs. Gates said, you know what? You've been coming in here like a freak every day for weeks, seeing if it's been turned in or if you're on the list to get it. She's like, why don't you just check it out over the summer? I'll let you check it out over the summer. So that was like my book for the summer. And so thank God for eBay. I was reliving my childhood. And
you tracked it down. That's awesome. Okay. Yeah, I remember I found that Marion T. Place book, and I think it was at the public library when I was growing up in Minnesota. So when I was about the same age, 8 or 9, and this was in the 70s, that was definitely an influential book. But I have a similar story quickly that my high school library had a book called Abominable Snowmen, Legend Come to Life, which is by a guy named Ivan Sanderson, one of the founders of cryptozoology. And it's a really thick book. Mm-hmm. I mean, it talks about Bigfoot, but it also has the Yeti and Asian wild men, Bigfoot creatures around the world, kind of a census of all the worldwide creatures. Well, through the years when I was in high school, I checked it out all the time. And I was really the only one that was checking it out, because when you looked at the library card on the inside of the book, it was just me.
Right.
So as a graduation present, when I graduated from my high school, the librarian just gave me the copy and said, you know, I think you're the only one that ever checked this book out. I know you really loved it. So I still have it to this day. It's one of my treasures.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So early on, I was just fascinated. I was kind of a latchkey kid. And so I watched a lot of TV when I came home from school. And when Cox Cable came to Omaha, Nebraska in the early 80s, I started finding all these shows. Oh, like In Search Of, that was on like WGN and with Leonard Nimoy. Yep. And so just all, and then I fell in love with Art Bell, and every once in a while he would have a Bigfoot show. But all these, I'd always like go and look for things about the Patterson-Gimlin film. And mm-hmm. I had Bob Gimlin on the show a couple of years ago, which is...
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What a highlight. It's one of those shows where I barely talked. It's just like, I was just listening to Bob the whole time, you know, peppering a question here and there, but...
Oh, yeah. He's like, I jokingly refer to him as Prince when he shows up at Bigfoot conferences. He's got an entourage and everyone's just like, oh, he's a great guy. I love Bob. Yep.
So I was fascinated with the Patterson-Gimlin film. Whew, man, I mean, that was, and still is, so fascinating, so yeah. Mystical. So I, you know, every couple of weeks, I probably just, you know, click on a YouTube video and just watch. I'm like, man, that is not a guy in a suit. And so let's talk a little bit about like the Gimlin film. When we're looking for, mm-hmm. You know, investigations, when we're looking for proof, when we're looking for any kind of nugget of proof, behind this mystery, it always comes to me back to Patterson-Gimlin and what a remarkable film that is.
It is the gold standard of photographic evidence, even after over half a century. I finally had the opportunity, Brian, to visit the film site this year for the first time in July. So we went down and I met up with the Bluff Creek Project, who's been maintaining the site. And it's changed quite a bit. Obviously, it's grown up. When it was filmed, when the film was made in 67, it was just a few years after a major flood event that had flattened the area and taken a lot of vegetation out. But, you know, there are trees, but these guys have done an excellent job down there in finding landmarks. And believe it or not, even after all this time, there are certain trees. And I actually have, I'll show you, this is my Bigfoot nerd moment, but here's a,
I love it.
A piece. If you can picture the Patterson-Gimlin Bigfoot film in your head, there's a giant tree that's laying across the front of the frame. You know what I'm talking about? It's kind of on the ground.
Yeah.
This is a piece of that tree.
The tree.
It's still there. It's rotting away, but that giant tree. But anyways, the thing that was exciting about being at the film site was understanding the perspective, because they figured out where Patterson was kneeling. They've got that marked, and they figured out where Patty, the trajectory of her walk, which I retraced, and where she turns in frame 352 and so forth. And I think the greatest revelation, well, twofold. One was how close Patterson was to this thing. I mean, he was within 90 feet. It looks farther because he was using kind of a wide lens on his Kodak K100 camera. It was kind of a wide angle lens, so it looks like she's farther away. Mm-hmm. He was pretty close to it when he kneels down and she turns and so forth. And the other thing is that area is actually a lot more lush. And I mean, if you look at Bluff Creek today, it looks like an Amazon rainforest. I mean, there's a really lush vegetation. There's lots of bear activity, diverse. It's a great, rich habitat. So, you know, that was kind of exciting.
And no sightings on your own there?
No, a bunch of us camped down there. There's a famous camp called Louse Camp, which is close to the film site. And all the greats in Bigfoot had camped there. Renee DeHinden, John Green, Peter Byrne, Tom Slick, Bob Titmus, all those guys were down there at one time or another. So we camped at that site, and there were some young Bigfooters there, early 20s, that were very enthusiastic, and they were filming documentaries and things, and they thought there was a lot of activity going on. You know, they were like, did you hear that? There was something throwing rocks, and this happened. I guess I missed out. The one weird thing that did happen to us is we were walking up the road at night where Jerry Crew cast one of the very first Bigfoot cast in 1958. It's just up that from that campsite. And so that area is very steeped in a rich history of Bigfoot activity. But we were walking that road at night, a few of us, and we had this dog with us that had been very gregarious and, you know, it was like the most friendly, affable, goofy dog. And suddenly the dog's tail went between its legs and it wouldn't move.
Is that right?
And the owner was really freaked out. He's like, he never acts like this. And we had to kind of literally drag this terrified dog back to camp. So that was a little weird. I was like, wow, that dog really did radically change his disposition and get spooked by something. But who knows? Maybe they're still out there.
Yeah. Now, you just didn't wake up one day and decide that you're going to go looking for Bigfoot. I was kind of researching you, so I don't always ask the questions that you've been asked, but I was looking at your life story, and what a childhood that you had, man. Your mom and your dad, they took you on vacations. Like, I was reading like all these places that you had been, and like, not just like California or Florida. I mean, you went, you know, on expeditions. You went on like not just a standard vacation.
Yeah, literally around the world. One trip, my mom and I circumvented the globe over a period of a few weeks. And so, yeah, I was very blessed at a young age. Traveled to 26 different countries on 6 continents and the Amazon jungle, Galapagos Islands, Australian desert. I mean, lots of amazing. Yeah, so I was very blessed. And to this day, I think that really molded a lot of my sense for adventure and exploration. And you know, my mother was very influential, as was my father. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I love stories like that where you get the sense of adventure just kind of awakened inside of you. And to this day, I mean, you're still on television. You're a world renowned researcher. You are an expert. I always joke that you can't say the word expert because we don't have a Bigfoot in a zoo.
It's true.
But on all things Bigfoot, you're so learned. So wonderful to have you on here.
Thank you.
We were talking about Patterson-Gimlin, and that's the gold standard, like evidence. It hasn't been debunked. You know, I even asked Bob Gimlin if he thinks Patty's still out there. And he's like, oh yeah. You know, I've heard from some of my Native American friends that every once in a while, they might see somebody that looks like Patty wandering around out there. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think so. Bob, I think, still lives up there in Yakima, Stevenson County, which has always been a hotbed of activity. He and Patterson were both from that area. So they didn't need to go to Bluff Creek. Well, I mean, I guess I'm glad they did because they got the film, but they were certainly doing a lot of Bigfoot research in their own area there in Washington state, you know, even prior to capturing the film in 67.
I heard some interviews with you and you made no bones saying that you're 99% sure that there's a Bigfoot creature.
90.
Okay.
Yeah. 90. I mean, maybe that fluctuates.
What's holding you back from a city slicker like me that thinks it's 100%?
I haven't seen one with my own eyes.
All right, that's fair.
And, you know, I've spent years and years. I've done research in active areas all over the continent. And I've heard vocalizations that I'm convinced are probably Bigfoot. I've seen footprints, other physical trace evidence, but I've never seen one with my own eyes. And that's the only thing that's kind of holding me back. Well, plus, you know, I try to, as a cryptozoologist, I try to view these mysteries through the lens of zoology. Okay. Zoology is the very forgotten word in cryptozoology. So in terms of science in general, science is a very agnostic pursuit. I mean, most scientists will tell you nothing is 100%. I mean, you know, maybe gravity, there's, you know, math, but, you know, there's always a little room for error, you know, and if you follow the news, I mean, you know this for yourself, because every few years there's a new discovery in paleontology or geology or, you know, some science where they say, wow, we were actually wrong. It's, you know, now we're thinking that, you know, this is the most likely theory or whatever. So, you know, you have to be fluid. So I think 90% is a good scientific perspective to look at something like Bigfoot, you know, as an agnostic, not having seen one, because it's, you know, there's always a chance. It would be, to me, a very unlikely chance that this is all some kind of weird cultural phenomenon and people are just, you know, constructing these things, but in our minds. But a lifetime of research tells me the opposite. There's got to be something to it.
Well, you've got a lifetime of research, but we're also talking about, when you said culturally, you know, Native American cultures separated by continents, separated by oceans, separated by centuries, they all have some kind of wild man, some kind of brother tribe I've heard thrown around. All kinds of stories that have persisted ever since, you know, hieroglyphics and written communication and cultural stories that way.
That is a compelling line of evidence. I think one of the major ones is the widespread, not just the modern eyewitness reports, but as you mentioned, all of these Native American traditions with similar stories of wild men, hairy wild men, savages, bushmen, hairy man, Sasquatch, Skookum, Zonaqua, Bukwus, Sihatik, Arulatak, Uruyuli, Gaget, Gilyuk. I mean, there's so many different Native names that describe these big, hairy, you know, a tribe. I'm not saying they're human, but, you know, I guess they looked human-like enough to the natives where they said, well, there are these big, hairy, this tribe of big, hairy men that live in the wilderness. So
I'm glad it is
fascinating.
As a podcaster, I'm glad that you just said all those names, because I was going through your book and reading all these different Native American names for the creature. And I'm like, I'm not going to ask him what all these things are because I can't pronounce them. So I'm glad that you've done the research. You're on the show. So we're going to talk about them that way. What's great about your book though, like I was going through and like the history, you like talk about different sightings, like important ones. And even like the Albert Ostman story, which I remember reading about when I was a kid, all these different sightings. And then you go through a great part of the book I thought was super interesting when we were talking culturally, that there was all these things that are related and you kind of group them a little bit together as like Littlefoot. So like, not only do we have the giant 8 foot tall, 7 foot, 8 foot tall, upright biped hominid, but there's also stories of like 3 foot, 2 foot, little humans covered in hair that again, separated by continents, separated by oceans, separated by centuries. There's all these different stories that are passed down about these creatures that are still being spotted and natives keep seeing them or talking about them. And modern researchers are still going down to find them.
Yeah. You know, Littlefoot, as I call it in my book, has been something that's been embedded in Bigfoot lore for decades, but has never been as prominent. You'll hear the stories here and there about the little people, which are often described as being covered in hair, which sounds like a kind of a pygmy version of Bigfoot. Now, you could certainly make an argument that in some cases we could be dealing with juvenile Sasquatches, because Bigfoot is not born 7 feet tall. So there might be a stage where they are little and people see the juveniles and they report them. But it's interesting, Brian, most of these traditions of little people, Littlefoot, that I hear about are from the natives, Native Americans, from the Quechqui Maya in Belize when I was doing research down in Central America, the Lakota tribes of the Dakotas when I was up there told me that these Littlefoot creatures were on their reservation and creating havoc, basically stealing food and their pet dogs and things. When I was in Alaska, I met some Inuit people that told me about the Inukans, the little people. So typically when I hear about the Littlefoots, it's not from, you know, the quote unquote white man, it's from the natives that say, you know, because I'll ask them about Bigfoot and they always say, oh yeah, we have, you know, hairy man or whatever, but we also have, you know, the little ones, the, mm-hmm. you know, the little people, and they have a very different names. Again, Inukans, Hachesitehi, Duende, Awakule, so, you know, so on and so forth. And they're always described as little 3 foot tall Sasquatches, basically very broad and powerful, but covered in hair, ancient looking faces, as they describe them. So it seems like you could make an argument that there would be potentially two species, you know, as improbable as that sounds, a big one and a little one that mm-hmm. are both very similar in terms of, you know, man-like, covered in hair, living out in the wilderness. So it is a fascinating pursuit. And, you know, backing up, Brian, and looking at the global aspect of Bigfoot, Yeti, and worldwide mystery hominins, you know, the Yeti is typically described, a lot of people don't realize this, but most Yeti descriptions are of smaller Yetis, about 4 to 5 feet tall. You have something called the Orang Pendek, or short man of Sumatra, which is like a famous pygmy, Bigfoot, Littlefoot, mm-hmm. The Ibu Gogo, and so forth. So you have worldwide traditions, just like with Bigfoot and Sasquatch and Yeti, you have worldwide traditions of Littlefoot from virtually every continent.
Another thing I find so fascinating about Bigfoot, like we can a little bit later maybe talk about some of the supernatural, you know, aspects of the creature, and those are all fine. And I don't like to dismiss those at all because I think it might be part of the mystery for sure. But what I like about your book, and what I'm always kind of, when I always kind of steer myself toward, is when we start talking about like the biology of this creature, or, you know, physical characteristics, the ecology, how does this thing remain hidden? Its history, just all these things that are like concrete, real scientific, you know, like, mm-hmm. like answering the questions. How many are there? How do they reproduce? Where do they live? Are they scared or wary of humans? And that's why they avoid us. And unless it's a chance encounter here and there when we're kind of in their neck of the woods, you know, they don't come wandering down Broadway in New York, you know, it's always up in the mountains. It's always, we're on their turf, you know? So all these talks or all these discussions of the physical characteristics and what they have to eat, and how many there must be of them to survive and to have some population, at least in the United States, are always so fascinating to me.
Yeah. And although as strange as it sounds, there are occasionally urban Bigfoot, mm-hmm. quasi urban Bigfoot stories. One is something called Trash Squatch, which is said to lurk among the garbage piles of Staten Island, up there in New York. I was up visiting my sister up there recently, and we were talking about Trash Squatch sightings. There at one time it was said there was a Bigfoot living in the sewers near the Cleveland Zoo in Cleveland, Ohio. Uh-huh. And here in San Antonio, where I live, there were some sightings of a Bigfoot next to the old Kelly Air Force Base back in the 70s, which is actually pretty much in San Antonio, the 10th largest city in the United States. So it's pretty rare that you get those urban Bigfoot sightings, but that was kind of a fun digression. But yeah, to your point, you know, again, as a cryptozoologist, if Bigfoot exists, if we take that as a working hypothesis, okay, we've looked at the evidence, we think Bigfoot has to exist. Then you have to answer, you know, very obvious questions that apply to any living creature. You know, it's ecology, it's zoology. I mean, there has to be a food source. You have to have a viable population. They have to have a sufficient habitat and so forth. You know, they have to have behavior patterns which are fairly consistent. Mm-hmm. Are they nocturnal or diurnal? Are they, you know, do they walk primarily on two legs? Do they go down on four? I mean, you know, so I like to explore all of those different questions as a cryptozoologist. So, you know, I'm trying to make a case. I'm trying to build a case that Bigfoot does exist, but I'm trying to do it from that, again, that zoological perspective. Okay. It's an undiscovered animal. It's very rare. It has adapted behavior patterns that make it very hard to find. You know, that's the only way that I could explain how Bigfoot could exist.
Sure. And then people will always say, I lovingly call my friends that think I'm crazy. I call them squares that, you know, that don't believe in like, or don't entertain thoughts of Bigfoot or ghosts or things like that. They're no offense, friends listening to the show, but you're kind of square to me sometimes.
Dream killers.
I like that. That's totally it. But sometimes to me, it's a lot like, when we start talking about ghosts, we don't know what a ghost is. We have a pretty good idea of what society says a ghost is, you know, a spirit of somebody that's died, that's persisted after bodily death. I mean, that's usually the generally accepted thing. And so a lot of my, squares or skeptics will say, well, why haven't we found one yet? All these years of looking and nobody's found one. And so there are so many reasons just out in nature why you won't find a carcass of a Bigfoot all the way. And you can even talk about if they're more human than ape or human than animal, maybe they bury their dead or they have some kind of burial rituals or they have, you know, things that as a family unit. Well, there's a thing too, Bigfoot, do they have a family kind of unit or a tribe kind of a thing? So it's just so fascinating, all those kinds of aspects of it too.
Yeah, absolutely. And those are all things that I tried to cover in the book to some extent. I mean, you know, playing devil's advocate, one of the arguments against, you know, the reality of Bigfoot is what, you know, it seems like most of the, virtually all of the sightings are of a single individual. And, you know, all primates are very social animals, from humans to monkeys to apes, all have very structured social organized groups, troops, harems, families that, you know, kind of stick together. And, you know, so why do we only see usually one Bigfoot at a time? Well, you know, who knows? Maybe they have adapted to be more solitary. Maybe there are more of them there. You're just only seeing one at a time and they're so good at hiding that the others are out of sight. So yeah, those are all good questions. You know, I one of the things I talk about in the book, and it's just pure, you know, as you said earlier, I'm not an expert. It's all pure speculation.
I didn't mean that as a put down.
No, I don't. I start all my lectures that way. I'm not an expert in Bigfoot because I don't have one here to show you, but
correct.
I can speculate on a very high level because I've been accumulating knowledge about Bigfoot and Sasquatch for 40 years from the very best sources and been looking at it objectively without a lot of bias. So what I can tell you is that the best guess, if Bigfoot exists, there has to be a population in the low thousands across North America, period. You can't have 100 Bigfoots spread out across the continent, accounting for all of the sightings and maintaining a breeding population. It's just impossible. So you know, there'd be a few thousand. I don't know, 4,000 is kind of my best guess at the moment, which sounds like a lot. But if you spread that out across the continent, it's still a very, very rare animal. Just enough, you know, they have just enough of a population there to breed and maintain some level of a, you know, even though it's a very critically low population density, like a lot of animals, they're probably sadly vulnerable. But still, if you consider in terms of bears, there are like, you know, 650,000 bears across the continent. So there's really 150 bears for every Bigfoot is kind of the breakdown, 160 maybe. And, you know, aside from people that live in really bear intensive areas, I mean, you might see a bear once in a while, but unless that bear has become used to eating out of your garbage can, you're probably not going to see him that much. So,
right. So
yeah, that's one of my arguments is that Bigfoot is just, it's a very rare animal. That's why we don't see them more often or have better evidence at this point and why we haven't found a body. You know, there are probably a number of factors involved there, as you suggest. Maybe they bury their dead, you know, maybe like a lot of animals that are dying, they crawl into a hole or a, you know, heavy brush and obscure their remains.
Sure. So, like, you know, like even household pets, dogs and cats, they can kind of sense sometimes when they're going to pass or they're not feeling well, or, you know, their time has come and they go and hide for whatever reason. And with the forest, the way it is, there's all kinds of animals that want to take a bite out of you if you pass away, you know, and then plus the climate of the forest floor, it won't take long for a carcass, you know, if it's way out in the woods someplace, you know, a place where humans don't go very often, it doesn't take very long for a biological form to break down and decompose and be pretty much untraceable, at least to the naked eye.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, again, if you, I always like to kind of, like I said, you know, play devil's advocate, you know, do some critical thinking. So one of the problems with this situation, though, is that we don't have any Bigfoot fossils yet in like Pleistocene deposits, which are very prevalent across North America from the last ice age. All of the major animals, large animals, are well represented in Pleistocene. You know, everything that we have today, the bears, beavers, deer, elk, you know, whatever, mountain lions, and then even animals that went extinct, you know, in recent, you know, thousands of years ago, like we had camels in North America and cheetahs and hyenas and things like that. So, but you would think that in the past that there were greater numbers of these Bigfoot Sasquatch animals on the continent, and they're very big animals. So it just seems like at some point we would have found, you know, some type of Pleistocene fossilized jawbone tooth. So that is one thing that kind of bothers me, is that why don't we have a Bigfoot fossil? It seems like we would have found something by now with all of the, you know, paleontologists out there working these Pleistocene deposits. But, you know, but again, it's, you know, it's all speculation. We just don't know.
Sure. So I touched on it a little bit earlier. Do you give any thought at all to, you know, perhaps the more supernatural aspect of Bigfoot, and like connection to UFOs or portals or time slips, or the Bigfoot is the ghost of a Neanderthal or a primitive creature? I mean, you can go, you know, you can go crazy down these rabbit holes, but I don't. It's the kid in me. It's the wonder. It's the magic of the universe. Like I don't dismiss those things. I don't put a lot of stock, but at the same time, it's so much fun to think about all these different aspects of this mystery. Do you ever kind of step outside the biological box?
Well, that's, of course, that's one of the top questions that people ask me on a regular basis. Could there be some, you know, interdimensional supernatural element to Bigfoot, and that's why we haven't found them? What I like to tell people, first of all, I am an open-minded person. Okay. I try to remain a very objective. I think there are a lot of things going on in our world that we still don't understand. I'm fascinated by my friends that are ghost hunters and UFO investigators. And I follow their research with enthusiasm. I think it's really interesting. But my, you know, the evidence that I've been evaluating for the past 40 years in my experience traveling around the continent, searching for Bigfoot and looking at evidence and working with other investigators, I haven't seen anything that would lead me to believe that it's Bigfoot is a supernatural spiritual phenomenon. It still seems like it. I mean, it leaves behind footprints. I got a whole wall of them here behind me. it seems to leave behind hairs, scat, perhaps manipulate, you know, nests, things like that, that have been found that aren't conclusive, but they're, you know, they're compelling that it's simply a relict hominin, something, you know, a great ape, you know, perhaps from hundreds of thousands or millions of years ago that still survived in small numbers. And we just haven't learned that yet. But, you know, there are a few people in the Bigfoot community that have more of that kind of view, that it is a more of a metaphysical construct. There are at least a few researchers that I really respect that have that point of view. So, you know, people are entitled to that. What bothers me, and, you know, maybe that's an too aggressive way to say it, because, you know, I try not to get bothered too much by what people are entitled their opinion. But I see this a lot in the Bigfoot groups that I'm in, kind of the broad open Bigfoot groups, not the real serious researcher based groups, where people will just post and say, well, this is what I believe. Well, you know, of course, everyone's entitled to have a belief. But, you know, as a Bigfooter, I'm telling you, there's nothing to back it up other than the fact that you believe that. You know, it's like it's not the evidence or the data that's leading someone to form that opinion. It's just what they want, you know, to think, which is, you know, again, that's a freedom that we all enjoy, but it's, you know, it's just not the way I like to look at it. You know, I think it's a really serious, really cool mystery. And I think it's best if we approach it as scientifically as possible and base it on, you know, accumulated knowledge, evidence, and data, and not just like, you know, what we think is cool.
Sure.
And to your point, I mean, there's also the cultural aspect, which is a lot of people, especially people I know, really like the weirdest stuff. The weirder, the better. I mean, Right. That's something I hear all the time. Oh yeah, I like the weird, but you know, weird, high strangeness. And, Sure. You know, so it's Yeah. Like Bigfoot is weird enough as an undiscovered animal that's 8 feet tall and walks like a human's covered in hair. That's pretty weird, but if you can suddenly connect it to UFOs and portals and ghosts, then there's like a whole nother level of weirdness there that people can embrace if they like that.
Right. I like to entertain those ideas and listen to them, and I don't dismiss them, but I'm really drawn, you know, later back to, like you said, like the data and the research and what evidence we can accumulate. And with these eyewitness testimonies, especially the last 100 years or so, when you have hunters going out in the woods and, you know, they're armed. And the stories that always strike me are these hunters that go out and they encounter one, they pull up a gun, they look down their scope, and they can't pull the trigger because it looks so human to them, you know, and they really are shaken by it and they're disturbed by it because they, you know, they train their rifle on it and then they just can't pull the trigger on it because, first of all, it's Bigfoot, mystery, wonder, mysticism, whatever, folklore, all that. But at the same time, they aren't sure what they're aiming at is an animal. So I know we talk about, you know, descended from the apes and things like that, or maybe it's just some species of ape. But at the same time, it seems to be, in a lot of the stories through folklore and Native American traditions especially, talking about how it's pretty close to human in a lot of ways.
Well, certainly it has a locomotor system that's almost identical to ours, the way it moves. Long legs, long stride, dramatic arm swing. So, I mean, it walks very erect. And so it look, you know, people in that respect, as far as what the face looks like, very few people get close enough or have a good enough look. And there's a lot of subjective thinking there, but you're right. I mean, one of the most famous Bigfoot sightings is going back to the 1950s and a guy named William Rowe, 1955 at a place called Mika Mountain in British Columbia, mm-hmm. had this female Sasquatch and she didn't know he was there and he was in the brush with his rifle. And, you know, he was one of the first ones that, like you said, had it trained in his sights and thought, you know, it looks too human. I you know, and actually Brian, any trained hunter will tell you that, you know, in the rules of hunting, you don't shoot at anything if you can't identify exactly what it is. Correct. I mean, that's just common gun safety protocol. You know, mm-hmm. if you can't identify an animal, you don't pull the trigger.
Right.
And so I don't know. I think there's a lot of reasons there. Now, it's possible that at some point in history, someone did shoot one and they probably thought they'd get into a lot of trouble. And so they never told anybody or, you know, who knows? Again, that's just speculation. But you're right. That seems to be a common theme. And there are a couple of sightings or encounters in the book that I write about like that, where people said they, mm-hmm. and even like, you know, going back to the Patterson-Gimlin film, I mean, Bob had it was like a 30-06 or a, you know, he had a pretty good, and he was a good shot. You know, he's told me that. He said, I'm a good shot. I could have, but you know, they had talked about it ahead of time and they, well, you know, we don't want to shoot this thing if we don't have to, unless we feel like we're in danger. But, you know, when they wrote up on this thing, there's a famous, you know, quote, Roger said, cover me, as he slid off his horse with the camera to run at this thing. Oh, yeah. And Bob said he didn't point the rifle at it, but he dismounted and had the rifle. And that's, he's thinking that's why the Bigfoot turned back. Patty, the subject in the Patterson film, turned back and looked at Bob, because he was getting off his horse, that movement. And, you know, maybe she knew what a rifle was, who knows? But, you know, some animals have learned that behavior through generations. But yeah, you're right. No one's pulled a trigger. I certainly don't advocate that. Maybe years ago I would have been more open to that, but you know, I don't think that's essentially necessary at this point. So
yeah, I would not be in favor of shooting one. I think, you know, it's like Don Ameche at the end of Harry and the Hendersons. You know, he finally saw one just when he was giving up hope, and I don't just the look on his face in that movie, and it's just a classic fun family movie, but I can't imagine barreling down and shooting one just to prove that it exists, because, well, you know, earlier we were talking about, you know, we see one solitary Bigfoot walking around out there, and perhaps that's the hunter of the tribe or the hunter of the family, and the rest, the mom and the children are nestled someplace safe, and he's going to return home with I'm just wildly speculating, but I mean, I can't imagine or making a family of Bigfoot orphans or something.
No,
like
that's a reality. Or again, I think Bob and Roger had this talk at the film site, but you know what they thought, you know, cause different size footprints had been found in that area over a course of years. Mm-hmm. It was a common belief among researchers there were at least three different individuals based on their foot sizes in that area. So they were actually concerned about if they shot it, that the other two or more would suddenly, you know, emerge from the wilderness, and then you're surrounded, and that's, you know, that's pretty much the end, isn't it? So, right. Yeah, I think, you know, no, I'm sorry. I keep kind of going off on these wild tangents, but.
Oh, I love it.
I think the main thing I try to encourage Bigfoot researchers to do these days is to search for remains. It stands to reason that if these things exist, and even if they're very rare, they're big, and at some point they're going to die of natural causes somewhere. Mm-hmm. And therefore their remains are going to remain, some remains, bones, teeth, something. So, and also, you know, you also have eDNA, which is a burgeoning tool in cryptozoology. So we can now take DNA out of water and soil and air. And so it's, the technology is really favoring that if these things exist, that we will and should be able to find physical evidence.
Yeah. You know,
something that we can take to science, to zoologists, and say, there it is, you know, this thing exists. So,
yeah, I had Dr. Maria Mayer on last year. And talking to her, and you know, we were talking about eDNA and what a breakthrough that kind of is, and what a tool that might be. It might be useful when looking for this mystery.
Absolutely.
Now, I've only read one of your books, and I know you've got a bunch of them. The Bigfoot one naturally just jumped right out at me. So as the years and months go by, I'm gonna really enjoy checking out the rest of your library and everything. And I know you've written other books about other cryptozoological phenomena. Dogman.
Mm.
What are your thoughts as we chat here about this this phenomenon that's kind of that's surfaced about a different kind of creature, kind of scary? People say it's part dog, werewolf. I've heard people say, well, it's genetic experiments gone wrong, or it's supernatural. But there's a lot of sightings of a kind of a dog man creature. And it's not the best name for it at all. Not that Bigfoot's great, but I mean, everybody knows Bigfoot when you talk about it. But so have you had much thought or research into the dog man phenomenon?
Well, yeah, admittedly, I've only, you know, and talk about, you know, what we were just talking about a few minutes ago about weird, you know, dog man is obviously a lot weirder than Bigfoot because it, you know, as you said, I mean, at least for Bigfoot, you can find things in the fossil record that look exactly like Bigfoot, but Dogman, half man, half dog, as the name implies, that's just, it's a biological evolutionary impossibility. Mm, yes. So what are people seeing? I've personally only interviewed a handful of witnesses that have seen these things. They're very sincere and, you know, convinced that they saw these things. So I'm not disputing that. I've investigated a handful of cases. But I'm not as much on board with the Dogman research as some of my colleagues like Linda Godfrey, mm-hmm. Josh Turner, Jody Cook, and there are other people that are really all in on Dogman and really collecting a lot of sightings and reports. I don't know what to make of it. It's if it exists, I don't think it's an animal because, again, it just doesn't fit anything that would fit neatly into the paradigm of the zoological world. So therefore, what's the alternative? Well, it's something beyond our understanding. And so it's physical because people have said that it's scratched cars and they can see it in three dimensions and so on and so forth. And it chases folks from time to time, stuff like that. Eats roadkill. That's been some of the reports. So, it seems to have a physical aspect to it, but I, you know, typically with Dogman, and I guess my greatest contribution to the Dogman mystery has been that I organized the first and only Dogman conference back in 2016. It was called the Dogman Symposium. We had it in Defiance, Ohio, and we had about 160 people show up, and I gathered, you know, a handful of really top-notch cryptid investigators, including Linda Godfrey, Stan Gordon, and others to talk about it. And kind of the consensus opinion there was that, well, we think it's something metaphysical because particularly if you read into a lot of the accounts of Dogman, you know, people describe like other weird aspects. There's like this weird green amorphous fog or mist that people have described that kind of envelops the Dogman. Multiple eyewitnesses have described weird popping and clicking noises when they're having their encounters. Others have described having residual attachment type phenomenon where they have a Dogman sighting and then a lot of weird stuff happening to them, getting sick, violently ill. So, I mean, there's a lot of elements that seem to imply that it's more of a metaphysical, supernatural thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you can make a stronger case for Dogman for sure than with regard to Bigfoot. But as far as what it is, you know, I don't know. I mean, there are some interesting cultural things I've noticed about the Dogman community. And there's literally, it's blown up because you have a lot of popular podcasts and people telling their stories and so on and so forth. One interesting thing to me is that a lot of people want to associate Dogman to Bigfoot. In other words, Dogman researchers and investigators often will mention Bigfoot like, you know, either there's like a territorial dispute between Dogman and Bigfoot in this particular area and the Bigfoot stay on this side and the Dogman, or they work together and the Dogman and the Big, you know, so that's weird to me that the Dogman researchers always feel like Bigfoot has to be kind of thrown in. And then the other thing is that, there were two more things I want to say. One is that people don't want to associate Dogman with werewolf a lot of times. To me, it sounds like the same thing. I mean, werewolf basically in German means, you know, man wolf. Wolves and dogs are genetically very close. But people, oh, no, Dogman's not a werewolf. You know, a lot of the hardcore, it's like they want to create that delineation. And then the last thing is that, and again, this is just kind of my something that I mused over recently. The vast majority of humans love dogs. We are a dog-centric culture.
I have two.
Dogs have been, there you go. Dogs have been man's best friend for 15,000 years, thereabouts. They've been our faithful companion, our best friends. I think that Bigfoot hates dogs because it associates them with us. And that's something I read about in the Bigfoot book. Mm-hmm. But I'm just curious here, is the fact that humans love dogs so much, is that why one of the reasons that Dogman is so popular as a cryptid? Because it's a dog man. And I love dogs. I've got two dogs at home and I feel connected to dogs and dog, you know, so I don't know. That's just something I was thinking about. It's like, cause you have other weird cryptids like Mothman, which is still very popular.
Sure.
But you know, Dogman's definitely overtaken Mothman. I go on Dogman podcasts and I want to talk about Mothman and they're like, let's just stay on Dogman. You know, it's like,
right.
Go cool. Mothman's cool. You got this winged humanoid creature with giant red glowing eyes.
That's a harbinger of doom.
Yeah. I mean, and actually, I there's a method to my madness here, Brian, because one of the things I mentioned to people is I have researched these flying humanoids like Mothman for years, written a book, investigated, interviewed many witnesses. I think if Dogman exists and Mothman exists, they're the same mechanism. You basically have these creatures that are manifesting in our reality that are half man, half animal. Some have wings, some look like dogs, some are mermaids. I mean, who knows? But there are a lot of similarities between what I hear about Dogman encounters and Mothman encounters. I don't know. Maybe, you know, and you get into kind of these more of the metaphysical researchers that talk about these, you know, things that are connected on a level that we don't understand and stuff. So interdimensional, you know, multiverse things and stuff. So,
well, there's enough in our own strange physical world that we can reach out and touch and explore that I don't need to always go out and look for the crazy high strangeness. Although I welcome those discussions and I love listening to them, man. I can go down to rabbit hole with the best of them. So,
no doubt.
So I'm going to totally like check out the rest of your library because how much I enjoyed Essential Guide to Bigfoot, which is available on your website. And I will put a show link up so people can explore the library that you've put together of your books.
Awesome.
Now, as we kind of draw an end to our time here, you're a musician. What's your instrument of choice or what's your history there?
Thanks for asking. I actually was seriously, you know, music was my career for about 20 years. I kind of stepped away from it for the most part about 20 years ago, just because I was a little bit burned out and cryptozoology was beckoning at that time. Mm-hmm. But I started out as a keyboard player. You know, I was growing up in the early 80s. I was influenced by, you know, a lot of the new wave sort of electro synth pop bands like Kraftwerk, Gary Numan, Depeche Mode. And so, you know, I bought my first synthesizer when I was 15 and I also learned some piano, but, you know, so synthesizer, keyboard. And then, I started producing like electronic music, starting in the, mid to late 80s and then throughout the 90s. And it kind of evolved starting on. It was more like a sort of synth pop, Euro synth pop kind of stuff. And then it eventually became kind of heavier, darker, industrial sort of Nine Inch Nails sort of stuff. And I guess highlights, you know, I produced about 9 albums, toured around the country, got to open up for some cool bands, opened up for Motley Crue. That was probably my biggest show ever. And that was like 16,000 people and had a lot of fun and still have some very great friendships with people to this day. These days, I just don't have a lot of time to work on it. Mm-hmm. I do have, you know, some software and soft synths and things. And every once in a while, if I'm bored, I'll just play around with it. But I'm not seriously pursuing music. Haven't been for a while now, just because cryptozoology is really, you know, I'm very passionate about it. And it's very time consuming because I, you know, I'm into, as you know, all of it, not Bigfoot, yeah, Loch Ness Monster, Chupacabra, Mothman. I love it all. So
it's hard to find a sound isolation booth out in the middle of the Himalayas or in the Amazon jungle or, you know, where you can plug in your interface and start, you know, laying down some tracks. What a great conversation I've had with you, man. I don't have people on my show that I don't find interesting or I don't feel like I can talk to. And when I was reading your book and I was just going page after page, I'm like, oh, this is great. What a great book. I'm really impressed by it. And to have you on the program, I'm so glad that you were receptive to being on the program and just keep up all the great work, man. I'm going to be following your career and your books and your television appearances and everything else, man. I just have a lot of respect for you. And that book is just so well written, man. It's just everything. It is the essential guide to Bigfoot, man. And it's not just for people that have been reading about Bigfoot for 40 years. I think it's very accessible for somebody that wants to just jump in. That's always been really interested in things like that, whether or not they believe in it or not. It's a great read and it's thorough and it's well done. And having you on the program, man, what a treat.
Well, thank you, Brian. You've been a most gracious host. Great conversation, some excellent questions. And I really enjoyed it. Hopefully we can do this again sometime. Maybe talk about, you know, whatever's coming down the pike.
Yeah, man. And maybe I'll check you out. If you've got an appearance at a convention or something like that, I'll most definitely stop over and say hello. And yeah, we'll have to talk about like Chupacabra. We'll have to talk about Loch Ness Monster. I know you've got some books of these flying hominids too. We got a lot to talk about.
Fun stuff. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm going to be appearing at different conferences around the country this year, Bigfoot or paranormal conferences. And also, I'm currently on a series called The Proof is Out There on the History Channel. So if anybody's interested in, it's a fun show where we break down alleged video evidence of, and of course, I'm only involved in the kind of the weird creature videos, which has been a lot of fun. But I'm very proud of my work with the show. And they're very objective, you know. So if we think it's a hoax, that's what we say. If we think it's unexplained, we leave it at that. So it's comes on Friday nights. I think it's on after Ancient Aliens, but of course they shuffle these things around. So
sure, we'll keep an eye out for that, and I'll let the viewers, or excuse me, I'll let the listeners know where they can view you. So Ken, my man, thanks so much. I'm so glad that you were able to be a part of the Necronomicast.
Thanks again for having me, Brian.
There he is, everybody. Ken Gerhard, Mysterious Monsters, episode 227 is in the books. Speaking of books, Ken has written a ton of books. The Essential Guide to Loch Ness Monster, A Menagerie of Mysterious Beasts, Encounters with Flying Hominids, Monsters of Texas, and of course, The Essential Guide to Bigfoot. Bigfoot programming continues with the next episode of Necronomicast, and oh boy, is it a good one. Russell Acord is my guest. Bigfoot researcher, author, star of Expedition Bigfoot on the Travel Channel. Russell's going to give us the lowdown on being on that show and all about his interesting research. Going to be supersized this month. 3 episodes, not just your regular 2, because Bigfoot is that big. So thank you for listening to Necronomicast. Make sure you leave a review anywhere. Write about Necronomicast on the bathroom wall. I don't care. Have a great night, everybody. Get some sleep.